All right, so kind of thinking about 2020 behind us, I want to wish you all a happy new year, a happy 2021. And just it's kind of something that it was kind of said in our little kind of fellowship chat earlier. And I think about 2 Corinthians verse 5, I'm sorry, chapter 5 verse 17, where it says, anyone who belongs to Christ is a new person. The past is forgotten and everything is new. So that doesn't mean we become new, but when we initially come to Christ and surrender our lives to Him, it means that we have a new beginning every day. And thinking about that, 2020 is behind us. We have a new year. We have a new beginning every day, every week, and every year. So let's look to the Lord and hear His voice as we take on 2021. And what 2021 has to offer us. But for now, we are jumping into Daniel. So, and thinking about what I thought about in Daniel 11 of what I've been studying is that I think about if you notice that every generation thinks that they're the most unique, singular generation that's ever lived, right? And they're going to do things so different than their parents. They're going to grow up, they're going to have kids. And they're gonna parent their kid different. They're gonna do this different. They have all these different plans, right? And often those patterns are typically repeated over and over again. And I think about when we're out in public, right? And you say you remember things from your past. And I saw this young man. He was wearing this one outfit the other day, and I was thinking about like, huh. I should have kept that outfit. I wore that same thing back in the 90s, but it's back in style. And it's funny how things over time just kind of circulate over and over and over again. And I'm thinking about it. And it's sadly that this actually happens with national history as well. And and this author, he wrote that we're called. He wrote what it's called a bird's eye view of this cycle of men and cultures. And listen, if this sounds familiar, okay? Typically, cultures go from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage. Then from courage, it goes to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness. From selfishness to complacency, and then from complacency to apathy, and then apathy to dependency, right? And then you have dependency back to bondage. It's this vicious cycle. And no wonder God told the people in the Old Testament to remember what He'd done, okay? Deuteronomy, God said, and you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you these many years. Okay. And Daniel, and then so when we think about this, okay, and we think about the past and everything that's happened, Daniel chapter 11 is to us historical. Most of it's already happened. The last 10 verses are yet to happen. But for us, it's pretty much we're looking backward. Okay. And remembering what has happened in history, it's all about the wars, the oppressors, most of whom you've never heard before. And some of them, I'll be reading it, and I'm like, hey, I never heard of this one before. But sometimes we just don't hear about it. And I think about this, it's like a kid, right, in school who's getting bad grades in history. And his buddy says, how come you're flunking history? And he said, it's because the teacher keeps asking us about things that happened before I was born. And that's what history is. But and when thinking about that, these things, they're history to us. But for Daniel, they're all yet future. So let's kind of catch up here, okay? So Daniel, he's been reading Jeremiah, which said that Israel will be captive by the Babylonians for 70 years, okay? 70 years was up, so he dropped to his knees. Daniel prayed they would return and be strengthened and rebuild and become a glorious city once again, okay? But it never really happened. They returned, but just a small group returned, less than 50,000, that Bible tells us, okay? And great majority of the children of Israel remained in Babylon, okay? They become complacent. They become comfortable. They become paganized. They didn't want to disrupt their lifestyle. Kind of sounds familiar, right? Sometimes we get comfortable. I think about the time where I worked, I got out of the military and I was working at the security. I was in security management. And I felt like God just called me that it was the end of the road for that profession. You know, I was making a certain amount and I was called to leave to go to healthcare. But I was taking a large pay cut, but there was benefits to it. I was off weekends. I didn't have to work nights. But I ended up being so complacent, it was kind of hard, you know, to make that leap, that jump. And that happens with many of us, whether it's a career change, whether it's something we have to do or a decision that we have to make. We get so complacent. We get comfortable, right? And it's hard for us to move forward and we become stagnant. We become comfortable. And we tend to want to just not disrupt the lifestyle we're living. And that goes for many different things in our personal and professional life. So going back here, those that went back, they were unsuccessful. They didn't reestablish monarchy. The work came to a screeching halt. It just wasn't getting done. And Daniel, once again, in chapter 10, hits his knees and mourns. He prays. He fasts for 3 weeks. And finally, an answer comes. An answer comes, and it wasn't the answer he expected. And those could be difficult times. You know, we're wanting a certain answer, and sometimes we get an answer that is not expected. It's totally different than what we thought. But, you know, are we obedient and listening to the Lord? You know, the Lord is watching over us. He's our shepherd. And this answer, Daniel, the 70 years being captive in another place has been very difficult. But chastening of Israel will not end with the 70-year captivity. Okay? It's not going to have that ending. There's going to be more pain. There's going to be more suffering. There's going to be more sorrow, purging all the way through history, up to the very end, in fact. All the way up until the Messiah's kingdom. So that's the answer that we're getting to here in chapter 11. In chapter 11, verses 1 through 35 are prophecies that fit within the first 69 weeks of years, or 483 years, that we've already told you about in Daniel chapter 9. But now, the last part of chapter 11, 36 through 45 will deal with events, conflicts that will happen in Daniel's 70th week, or the great tribulation period, okay? So what we have in Daniel 11 is this marvelous demonstration that history is merely his story, and that for God is telling the future isn't any harder than knowing the past. So I've divided this chapter into two segments, because of the amount of detail that's taking place. You know, there's a lot going on that's being revealed to Daniel. So verses 1 through 2, we're going to begin with the chapter with Persia and the four future kings. 1 through 2, it says here, "And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece." So, this beginning of the chapter here, at this point in Daniel's life, the Babylonians have been overthrown. Now the Persians are in power. and an angel is speaking to Daniel. Okay. And typically, we typically don't think too much about angels in our daily life. We don't think about them protecting us. We don't think about them ministering to us. We don't give angels really much of a thought. And I do because I married one. But other than that, we typically don't. But the truth is, Scripture tells us that God, and we see this in Hebrews 1, God sends angels to those of us who inherit salvation to serve us. Or as it says, to serve or minister to those who inherit salvation. So, you know, thinking about this, and then if you thinking about angels, right? Did you know that the Bible, okay, out of 66 books, 34 books mentions angels, 17 in the Old Testament and 17 in the New Testament. They're spoken about 103 times in the Old Testament and 165 times in the New Testament. Okay, so just like we kind of saw last week, but we're seeing that there's conflict in heaven between demons and angels that affect what happens here on earth. And we should think about that more often. Okay. And thinking about that, I've heard this story about a pastor preparing a sermon for a very small congregation. And someone said to him, "Why you work so hard when your message will be heard by so few?" And this pastor said, "You underestimate how large the audience will be. If angels are looking, nothing that is done is trivial. I'm doing it for the glory of God and in the presence of all those witnesses." You know, what are we doing? You know, it's like, you know, just like when you go out there and you reach that one, there's a celebration in heaven. Regardless if there's one person that you're talking to about God or 10, the number doesn't matter because you're doing it in the presence of the glory of God and those that are witnessing, all these angels that are watching. Okay. And in here, an angel tells Daniel there will be three more kings in Persia until the fourth arose. The fourth king would be strong, rich, and oppose the realm of Greece. So we've heard about many of these kings earlier in Daniel. But this fourth king is somebody you know, King Xerxes. You're looking at me, hey, I know him. Well, if you know him, if you've ever read the book of Esther, he's the king that's featured prominently in Esther. One that he brings Esther into his company, that's Xerxes. Very wealthy, had a largest army in the ancient world. And he spent about 4 years raising this army of 2.5 million men. And it took 7 days to march the men across boats that acted as a bridge. This battle was the bloodiest battle in history. Although the Greeks lost, the army of Xerxes was decimated. Okay. So for the next 150 years, the Greeks waited to take revenge. And these visions and insights regarding the future of the Persian and the Greek empires were relevant because each empire attempted to wipe out the people of God at some time. So here we're getting a glimpse of this of these kings and kind of what's going on. And looking at verses 3 and 4, the rise of a mighty king, okay? So we're going to kind of start seeing this rise here. And it says, "Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has risen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these." Okay. So with that, okay, now the angel tells Daniel of a mighty king with great dominion, but his kingdom wouldn't endure and it would be divided after the death of a mighty king. And we know this from what we've just read in Daniel. And virtually every Bible commentator will say that this refers to Alexander the Great. We've already seen him highlighted in several chapters. In Daniel 7, the Grecian Empire was represented by what? A leopard with four wings. In Daniel 8, by a goat that came from the west rapidly coming with notable horn which broke off and four horns grew in its place. So then 150 years later, this mighty king did indeed arise by the name of Alexander, taking all that anger and revenge that the Greeks were feeling and began to conquer. Now, something about Alexander. He really was pretty great. He stands out in history as one of the most remarkable military leaders. And that's because in 332 BC, he seized the entire Persian Empire within 10 years. He conquered the world. He's a king of the world by the age of 33. He conquered from Europe to India. When he finally went to Babylon and his troops were exhausted, they couldn't go on any further. He's drunk one night. He wept because there's no more worlds to conquer. He done it all. And that's the night that he died of pneumonia. But notice what it says in verse 4. It said, his kingdoms will be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity. Okay. Following his death, his son didn't take over the kingdom. It was divided between his top four generals. But for this at this point for tonight, we're only focusing on two areas taken over by two of Alexander's generals, and that's Seleucus and Ptolemy. Seleucus took Syria north of Israel, and Ptolemy took Egypt south of Israel. So we have regents of Persia, ruler of Greece, and now come the rivals of the north and south. Now, if you look in your Bibles, okay, verses 5 through 20, the kings of the north and the south are kings that are directly affecting Israel. They directly affect Israel because Alexander took over the world. Persian Empire had taken over the world. They were in charge of them. But I mean directly affect Israel because we're dealing with a nation north and south of Israel. And by the way of geography, in the Bible, the Bible is all relative towards Israel. And when I was a kid, I was thinking about in school, right? The teacher shows us the world map, a map of the world. And what country was right in the middle? America. And that's what we think of ourselves. We're right in the middle. We're it. But on God's map, Israel's right in the middle. In fact, he says as much, Ezekiel chapter 5, verse 5, God says, and I quote, "See, I have set Jerusalem in the midst of all the nations that are around her." In other words, Israel is right smack dab in the middle. And that's why in the Bible, north, south, east, and west are relative to the nation of Israel. So because you have Israel here, you have the kings up here and the kings down here, Israel is sandwiched right in between. And they will get the brunt of all the battles. So here's the deal. The Ptolemaic dynasty down south grew stronger quicker, but not for very long. And we're going to see that here in verse 5 through 6. In verse 5 through 6, it says, "Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. After some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall become to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure. But she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times." So what we have here, this marriage between families of the king of the north and the king of the south, okay? This dynasty is growing, and eventually the northern kingdom, Syria, became very strong, and there's tension between the north and the south. Rather than fight the Syrians, the Ptolemy proposed that they form an alliance to ease tension. Now, the way of alliances were made back in those days is that one of the kings would give their daughter to the other king as wife, because that means that they're going to treat each other good, right? We would hope that it works out. Sometimes it would be more drama than it would be peace, but that's the idea, okay? So that's what happens here. This guy down south gives his daughter Berenice to the king of Syria named Antiochus Theos. And now the only problem is the king of the north is already married. He has a wife, and now he's given daughter Berenice as his second wife. No problem. He's a king. He divorces his wife, marries her. Well, his wife doesn't think too highly of that. Kills the new wife and their child and poisons her husband. So this whole alliance falls apart, just like this verse predicted. Now let's move on to verse 7 through 10. Verses 7 through 10, it says, "And then from a branch from her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north. And he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. And for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress." Okay, so from the south, an army defeats the kingdom of the north. We have this battle, and the angel tells Daniel, okay, the branch of her roots would come from the south and prevail over the kings of the north. So thinking about this before we move forward, okay, here we're having this interaction where the angel is talking to Daniel, explaining what's happening and showing him and revealing him to him what's happening here. Okay. So the angel tells Daniel about the branch of her roots, and enraged by what happened, okay, to the sister, okay, of the situation that we just read through, there's an avenged murder, okay. And that's Ptolemy III, third, invaded Syria and humbled the Syrians. While there, he rescued 2,500 gods the Syrians stole from the Egyptians years earlier. And in response to the Egyptian invasion, Antiochus III launched a counterattack against Egypt, claimed Israel as part of his empire. Now, as we start to see this stuff unfold and kind of go through this, we're going to see this. It's kind of a back and forth issue that's going through Israel back and forth between these kings, the south and the north. And let's look at verse 11 through 17. It says, "The king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north. And he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first. And after some years, he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. And in those times, many shall rise against the king of the south and the violent among your people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. So what's happening here? Okay, back and forth battle, now centering in Israel. Antiochus V came and determined, the fifth came and determined to solve the problem once and for all. Okay, he's had enough. He persuaded the Greeks to join him in invading Egypt once again. As the tensions began to ease, he would make one attempt by giving the king of the south his daughter. But this plot would not succeed. And I don't know what it is about these kings. They're like just offering their children out like their pieces. But we're going to see what his intentions were. Okay. Antiochus gave daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy the fifth of Egypt, hoping to gain a permanent influence and eventually control in Egypt. It's like sending in a spy, right? And to the great disappointment of Antiochus, the plan did not succeed because Cleopatra fell in love and refused to spy at all. In verses 18 through 19, we see, afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. So here, the king of the north is stopped and stumbles. After disappointing effort through the daughter Cleopatra, the king of the north would turn his efforts towards the coastlands, determined to conquer. When he went to the north to vent his frustrations by conquering the Greek islands, he came in contact with the Roman Empire. Antiochus planned to humiliate Greece, but was humiliated instead. He returned to his former regions, having lost all he gained, and died shortly after. Okay. Now, verse 20, it says, then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor a tribute for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days, he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. Okay. So this brief reign of the succeeding king of the north, okay? After the inglorious end of the king of the north, all military ventures had taken a toll on the north. His successor would raise taxes and meet a soon end. What I want you to see is the reason, okay? We're going through this detail here of what's kind of happening with these empires, but I want you to see the reason that so much is talked about here. And this is because all of the intrigue, all of the conspiracy, all of the wars, all of the bloodshed between the north and the south have Israel right between them. So when one king wants to attack the other king, they have to go through Israel. So for hundreds of years, Israel would be sandwiched between the hammer and the anvil, getting beat up by these kingdoms. Now, this happens for years and years until one particular king. And he's written about and giving more space than any other single individual in this chapter. One northern king in particular, the eighth Seleucid king by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, which takes us to the fourth and final division, the Rogue of Syria. Verses 21 through 28, we're going to hear about this vile person that comes into power and fails to conquer the king of the south. It says, in his place shall arise a contemptible person whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that the alliance was made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the kings of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for those two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant. And he shall work his will and return to his own land. So what's happening here? The angel again tells Daniel that after this brief reign of the former king of the north, the next king will be a vile person. He wouldn't be recognized as royalty, but shall take power by intrigue. The angel tells Daniel that the new king of the north, this person in verse 21, the vile person, would attempt a deceitful covenant with the king of the south. This would fail, and there would be a great battle that wouldn't change the balance of power. So these verses 21 through 24, it describes Antiochus Epiphanes, the rise to power. He's an illegitimate king. He had no right to reign. He seized the throne by flattery. He would seize cities he wanted or people he wanted and would come in with all the hearts and flowers and be sweet, always with an end game of taking them captive. And that's how he got to the throne. And then the verses 25 through 28, it describes his retaliation with Egypt, a peace treaty that was signed and it was broken. Both rulers actually broke this treaty. And then as we get into the last several verses, 29 through 25, the vile person turns on the Holy Land with violence. We're going to see this here, and it says, at the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south. But it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall be against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and the fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action, and the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. So this vile person, okay, now By this time, the Ptolemies down south were so sick of Antiochus that they called upon a new superpower looming in the west called Rome to help them. Rome sent a fleet of ships from the island of Cyprus who met Antiochus Epiphanes just down outside of Alexandria, Egypt, and they warned him strictly, pretty much saying, if you go to battle against this kingdom, you're going to also go to battle with us, Rome. We're going to be allied with them, and we're going to take you down. They drew a circle around him in the sand and said, you better make your decision before you leave the circle. So they publicly humiliated him. Now he's cornered. He puts his tail between his legs and goes back home. So now he's going, what, from south to north. He's going back home from south to north. And what land does he go through? Israel. What city does he go through? Jerusalem. In verse 31, we see that Antiochus, now humiliated and enraged, heads toward home. And it says, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. That's the temple in Jerusalem. And they shall take away the daily sacrifices and the place, the abomination of desolation there. So the importance of what we just went through is kind of seeing what's happening to Israel. He vented his anger on the Jews, killing 40,000 of them upon arrival and eventually slaughtering 100,000. There it is. Now, every time from here on, when we read about the abomination of desolation, this is the primary reference. Okay, what Antiochus Epiphanes did is what someone else is going to do in the coming future. The abomination of desolation. And here's what happened historically. Antiochus placed soldiers around the temple area, forbidding people to worship, forbidding people to sacrifice. And on the Sabbath, he sent soldiers to the city of Jerusalem to kill as many babies as they could. Fine. On another occasion, they went into the city of Jerusalem to kill as many women as they could find. He made adultery mandatory, erecting a statue of Zeus, killing a pig on an altar of sacrifice, forcing Jewish priests to eat pork, sprinkling juices of pig all around the temple, desecrating it, then made nudity public, taking what he called athletes and parading them nude in full view of the Temple Mount area, just totally in filthy manner, desecrating the temple. And depending on how we want to see things, you know, how things are going, what's going on, whether it's our country and other countries and society and the world and all this weird and crazy stuff that's happening, you know, it's kind of leading and pointing in one direction, but you know, you were kind of seeing what happened to Israel here. So poor Daniel, man, he's like 86 years of age and he's mourning and weeping because Israel isn't the glorious nation and capital like it once was. People have gone back, but only a few. Work has stopped. He's praying, mourning, fasting. He's doing all this. And the angel comes and goes, I've got your answer, Daniel. You're probably not going to like this, but 70 years of captivity are up, but there are more conflicts yet to come. You know what? Thinking about this, 2020 is in the past. We have 2021, 2022. Hey, there are going to be more conflicts, but there's a difference. We have our Lord and Savior to give us strength, to get us through those valleys. He doesn't leave us in those dark shadows. He doesn't leave us in those valleys. And thinking back here, this angel's telling Daniel, hey, there's going to be more to come. Because after 70 years will come a Xerxes, will come an Alexander, the rivals between two kingdoms for a couple hundred years, until eventually Antiochus Epiphanes will utterly obliterate your people. And that's what's going to happen all the way to the end. Now, I hope you're wondering, why would God allow that to happen? I know Daniel was probably thinking that. He's like, Lord, why? And verse 35 tells us. And some of those of, and some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, to purify them, and to make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. That's the answer to the question right there. Why would God allow that to happen? To refine, to purify, and make them white. That's our loving God. He could just say, hey, you know what? Forget you all. It's all overdone. But no. He allows these things to happen to build us up. And, you know, it's like saying, Daniel, hey, God's going to use this suffering. Would you agree that nothing is effective in driving people to God like suffering? Nothing gets our attention. We're so caught, you know, and we're humans. It's our human nature, right? We get so caught up on what's going on in the world, whether it's viruses, whether it's protests, whether it's all this other stuff. We get so caught up. You know, sometimes our attention gets locked in and we need something to get our attention. And I know we hate it. We'd all vote against it. If we could eradicate suffering in all the forms today, you know, we would probably vote for it. But guess what? God uses it. That's why Peter said in the New Testament, the trials of your faith have come so that your faith, more precious than gold, though refined by the fire, may be proved to be genuine. Okay. Now, I want to close with this question. Why the detail? Why all this detail in here of what's going on with these different kingdoms and all this stuff, right? And you have to understand all the chapters of Daniel. I was probably least excited about teaching this one until I got into it. And I was able to kind of see what was going on. Why the detail? And there's three reasons, okay? To highlight survival of the Jewish people. If you think about it, they shouldn't exist. They've been hassled and hounded, should be out of existence, but they exist. Jewish survival is miraculous. Okay, here's a sample of history, and I'm not going to cover all the dates or, you know, much of the dates, but just kind of give you a sense is look at what we just read. And then also we have in the past, Emperor Constantine outlawed Jews, killing them, dispersing them. The Jews were forbidden to hold public office in Europe, and over 60,000 were killed. The rise of Islam in the Arabian Peninsula, Jews were slaughtered even to this day. The Black Plague in Europe happened. The Jews were to blame for it. Half were killed. Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime exterminated 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. You know, so much has happened, but our Lord has protected them. They're there. They still exist. The second reason, to highlight the similarity of the Antichrist. We're going to read next week in the last 10 verses of the chapter about somebody else who's coming. And Antiochus Epiphanes is just a prototype of that Antichrist. The third, to highlight the sovereignty of God. Isn't it great when the Bible shows off God's track record? We see 135 predictions fulfilled that are mentioned in 35 verses. That's God's trademark. In fact, so often in the Old Testament, God says to the false gods, I can do what you can't do. I'm going to predict this, that. Can you do that? No. Can any of your false gods make this kind of predictions that I make? No. So every time God fulfills a promise that he has made or a prediction that he has made, it should cause us to swell up with faith. Think about this. Every tomorrow has two handles, a handle of anxiety and a handle of faith. Most of us like to grab the handle of anxiety. I don't know what's going to happen. Okay, so you don't know what's going to happen. So what? Every time God fulfills a promise that he makes, it should move us toward that handle of faith, because the thinking person will say this. If 135 prophecies that verifiable are found in 35 verses, then I think the rest of what he says is going to happen, like Jesus is coming back. Yet some will say, yeah, I've heard that before. I've heard these warnings for years. But you know what? Jesus is coming. The end of the world is coming, right? They say that. And I've heard people say that, well, maybe they're right, you know, but here's the thing. It's coming. It's going to happen. And here's my my final question. Can you come to church after week by week and sit after sermon, see God's power demonstrated in his word like this and remain unmoved? Because if you can, I'm sorry. When you see such verifiable evidence of an omniscience and the power of God in prophecy, it's absolutely amazing. We will pray, have the relationship with God, listen to his voice, and see what he will do for us. Not only tonight, today, tomorrow, this week, this year, but continue on and have that relationship. And see, just like he's brought the people of Israel through all these valleys, all this darkness, all these battles, he will do the same for us, regardless of what battle we're in. We just have to invite him into our hearts.